When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at Remarkable.com today.
This month at PostWrestlingCafe.com, go XL and you get live editions of Rewind to Raw, Rewind to Dynamite, and Rewind to SmackDown, featuring all the news of the day, your questions and answers, as well as feedback. PostWrestlingCafe.com, $6 gets you in the door.
Brandon Thurston from WrestleNomics is up next, and we're going to follow Brandon with John Pollock from Post Wrestling.
Thank you, and good afternoon, everyone.
But we can't ignore the math, okay? We can't ignore the data.
Go on Google Trends, type in your name, then type in mine. You're a straight line. I'm a pyramid.
I like the very direct question on that.
Television ratings, downward spiral. Buy rates, plummeting.
The time is now to turn the math around.
Welcome to another edition of Pollock and Thurston. It is John Pollock representing Post Wrestling with Brandon Thurston, CEO, CFO, CMO of WrestleNomics Inc. with us today. How are you?
Executive Chairman of the Board of Directors. I'm doing okay. How are you?
Do you have any super shares in WrestleNomics?
I have all the shares. I have not given any of them to WBD. I have them all.
Yes. You know, when we incorporated Post Wrestling, which we did in fact have to go through that process, I wish you were around during those days. We would have looped you into all of this. Yeah, we had to designate. So technically, some trivia for those out there. Wei Ting is technically the president of Post Wrestling. I am the vice president.
You're the vice president.
Well, yeah, I deferred to Wei. He controls all of our fates. So yes, that we had to basically flip a coin and Wei Ting.
Are there different classes of shares? Is it all single class?
They are single class shares. Okay. Yes. Okay. This was a level of detail that was very new to us in 2018-ish. Yeah. I would have been leaning on you for some advice. But here we are. We have plenty to talk about. We're going to be hitting on all the hits today. We're going to be talking about Vince McMahon. We're going to talk a little about Saudi Arabia and how punk rock it is to go to Saudi Arabia in 2025. And we're going to be giving you an update on what is the status of Dr. Carlin Kolker.
You're all wondering.
Everyone is wondering, as they have for the past couple of days. We're going to have some WWE press conference dialogue to follow. And who knows what else will sprout out from this. And of course, everyone's favorite, Netflix math. We're going to do Netflix. The latest stats from Netflix from a week ago. We also have Money in the Bank, international Netflix viewership as well. So all of that and more getting into things. But a week ago, Brandon, we were talking about the biggest name in all of professional wrestling, Ron Killings, gone from WWE, contract set to expire. And it took all of 6 days for the WWE to control Z that decision and bring back Ron Killings at the Money in the Bank show on Saturday night. And then Paul Levesque giving us a window into what to expect when Netflix debuts WWE Unreal, where we are going to present the stories like you have never seen them before, dropping all allusions to character and fiction and kayfabe. He was asked, what exactly is the deal with R-Truth?
I wanted to know exactly, was he actually released or leaving the company? And if so, how much did fans play a role in it? Or was there something else that made you guys decide, like, you know what, we want this guy still here?
I love the question. You enjoying the show? All part of the show, man.
Man, pipe bomb right here at the press conference from Paul Levesque. I don't think he loved that question. That would be my thought.
You don't think he did? He said he did.
I don't think he was being truthful in that particular reaction to that question. Not since we got the combo of John Elbra, Cameron Hawkins, and Brandon Thurston, the Holy Trinity at the Royal Rumble 2024 press conference, has Paul Levesque seemed to deflect so frequently.
Well, I think at least on that occasion, he was telling the truth. That he did not read the lawsuit and whatever else he said at that time.
They had a great week. We had a great week.
In some ways, yeah. There was a negative, but yeah. But he wanted to focus on the positive. I think he was being truthful in that
regard. Make an omelet without cracking some eggs. Trafficking
or
lawsuit,
some other things.
Netflix
deal,
rock on the board. I didn't think this was like, you know, earth-shattering, this particular response from Paul Levesque. But more so, it's just a continued example in a long line of Paul Levesque, who in these settings, it's very transparent. Like, Paul Levesque is, I think, very much likes doing these, where these are an extension of great job, boss, really great content. Tell us more. He wants these to be an extension of the product you see on screen. And when real issues are thrown his way, man, does this guy just get his back up against the wall. And not that this was to the extent of some of the other reactions we have gotten, but this was as simple as just stating, you know what, the fans wanted this guy back. We called a mulligan. Our bad. Now our truth is back. But he wasn't going to go that direction and admit that they maybe had a misstep here in the assessment of our truth and his popularity among its fan base, that they redid this one. Instead, it was just, hey, shut up and enjoy the ride. Quote Dwayne Johnson.
Yes. Well, I don't know. So I think, you know, they were having something of a fan relations issue in response to our truth. I don't know what verb to use. He's separating from the company. Let's be as a general as possible. And people were chanting, we want truth. During the show, right?
All of the programs last week, yeah.
So they decided to bring him back, and I think that makes sense. There's a positive to gain there in terms of harnessing this fan energy. And look at this promo that he just did on Monday. That was really strong, as you guys said the other night. Like, whoa, here's this guy who can cut promos, and it's pretty intense, and he's throwing off the comedy character and all this. It's very interesting stuff. So they're kind of responding to a fan relations or public relations issue here, and Triple H is responding to it by not really fully undoing the issue, by sort of basically saying, what are you supposed to take away from that? That he wasn't really, they weren't really going to let his contract expire. So I think, you know, there are enough fans, especially people who are going to tune into something like this. I know it's a minority of the audience who's going to be aware of this stuff, but nonetheless, those who are your sort of bellwether fans who are going to, you know, be your best promoters. They're going to be your strongest promoters, more strong promoters than you are as a wrestling promoter. They're going to tell other fans whether or not is WWE, is it good right now? Is it better than it used to be? And tell people whether or not to watch it. And the relationships that you have with those people is worth respecting. And, you know, the history of pro wrestling is just sort of a history of that mattering a little bit more over time, and the people in power in wrestling not respecting that because, you know, the history of wrestling, for one thing, these are all just marks that we're supposed to fool, and there's this sort of superiority of we're telling the stories, and you should not have any commentary about it. You should not have any you don't understand the business well enough to criticize it or have critical thoughts about it. Just sit back and enjoy. And there's apparently a point of view like that in Paul Levesque.
Paul Levesque has been, I think, he's been very savvy in this role ever since taking over NXT. I mean, here was someone that was...
Right.
You know, notorious in the sense of, like, here was the guy that was a dissenting voice when they
been the antithesis over the last decade or so.
Well, that's it. I mean, when Tough Enough came out, I mean, he was one of those voices that you always heard was most dissenting of just letting people into that aspect of the business. But despite whatever his image was to the outside wrestling fan, when he started NXT, he launched these conference calls, and you saw that this as a means of communication, and you heard Paul that wanted to, like, he invited the wrestling media in, and then it really wasn't until that Velveteen Dream series of issues that percolated on several of these calls that you got frustrated, Paul, and annoyed, Paul.
And that time is also the time where Dynamite is pretty beating NXT in the ratings.
It's an interesting period because NXT went from the hot thing among that wrestling audience, and then we go to the Wednesday Night War, and now the new hot product is in vogue among that core wrestling fan, and NXT is sort of playing catch up, and you're getting like some insight into, you know, Paul Levesque at this point. Like, he had, if you recall, like that first week or so of Dynamite being on the air, they had a special coming up. So you got to hear his exact reaction about, you know, the famous, this is a marathon, not a sprint. And in time, like Paul Levesque, he kind of goes into his imposed hibernation, reemerges after Vince McMahon's ouster, and is back in a very prominent position. And it's again, like, he is now back into that, I guess, a positive image enhancement that he has among this audience. But he knows the audience he is speaking to, but you see when he is throwing curveballs, whether it was at that Royal Rumble press conference, whether it was with Lucas Sharpio last year about very similar topic about talents with their contracts being up, with releases, and in this one as well. Like, it is a feeling of it. The perception to me is Paul Levesque ultimately wanting to engage with this media, but this undertone of, I am responsible for your livelihood. Do not critique us, the puppet master, that provide the storytelling. We are the ones in control of this. And I think that is very much the pedigree, pardon the pun, of a Paul Levesque that you do get glimpses into in these types of press settings.
And I think what the incumbent cynicism in wrestling and in wrestling leadership would say is, like, to a conversation like the one we're having now, is that, oh, well, certainly got you talking. Must be doing something right. Right? So it's actually a positive.
My follow-up would have been, what is the status of Carlito and Sarah Rowe?
Yeah. What's that storyline too?
Yeah. This came from Fightful, who had a lot of details on the Ron Killings story. They reported on Fightful Select that Fightful spoke with a higher-up in WWE who confirmed our order of events as reported, including Nick Khan taking over negotiations. In fact, we were told that when R-Truth had initially been approached for a return, that he didn't seem to entertain the calls. When Nick Khan took over, things opened up. It was also reiterated to Fightful that Truth's initial departure was not a work. We were also told that it is rare that Nick Khan gets involved in negotiations, but this one was important to the company and locker room, which it's kind of a fact that I don't think has been focused on too heavily, but that's a really interesting wrinkle to all of this is, like, this is not Paul Levesque being able to do what Vince McMahon could not do and bring Bruno Sammartino to the Hall of Fame. Like, this feels as though this had to go above the chain of command, and it was Nick Khan that had to be, you know, called in from the bullpen to lock down this return.
He might feel like he was overruled, which might add to the sensitivity. I guess the other concern that I think cynical minds in the wrestling business might put forward, which we heard some 10 years ago around someone named Daniel Bryan being put back into the main event of WrestleMania, is that by doing this, by bringing R-Truth back, by acquiescing to the fans trying to hijack the show, aren't you you're just going to encourage this all the more from now on? Anytime something happens that they don't like, they're going to chant and they're going to think that they're going to get their way, and you're not going to. The point of pro wrestling is to control people, not to let them control you.
I think it'll be interesting because inevitably there will be more cuts. I don't know how many people on the roster are going to invoke this kind of response that R-Truth does, but there's certainly those candidates that you could see. And this does open up a playbook for audiences to at least be taught that, hey, if we're loud enough, we can actually reverse course on some of these. That is something to all of this that I would imagine they're cognizant of. I'm also interested in Like, if you felt, if this were just a decision made, these releases in a vacuum, if the response would have been to this level by both fans and WWE to bring him back, if you didn't have some of these other stories that have popped up this year, you had, you know, the first scent of dissension among some of the fan base in the lead up to WrestleMania, all the stuff with The Rock. Then you had The Rock publicly speaking about this. There was this sort of dissension from the fan base over that. And then you couple it with facts of all these topics we talk about, escalating ticket prices, WrestleMania gets yanked out of a market for another part, and the counter programming with AEW, that it's at least you bundle all these things together. Was this just an easy win for WWE that, hey, let's just nip this in the bud. We kill these chants and we don't let this performer go elsewhere. And we give the audience, hey, you guys invoke this change and we listen to our fans. This was an easy PR win in the grand scheme of things.
Yeah. And I think it's taking something positive away from what a competitor could do with Ron Killings and putting him into your company. And the outlook, at least the short term outlook for him, looks really great for his character and what he's going to do on TV the next several weeks. So yeah, I think it was definitely smart. And I just, you know, again, this is sort of what the moral of the story was to me from that Reddit sentiment study I did a month or two ago, is that on a large enough scale, these little internet stories that have been dismissed over the last couple decades, if it's on a large enough scale, and we're not talking about just something that's happening in a corner of Twitter, something that is truly representative of the fan base, to the extent that you're getting things like chants that are happening on your, that are audible on your program, yeah, these things matter in a way that would have been insignificant, you know, certainly in the 90s.
The last thing on this, why is there such a difference? Like, we will talk about in AEW, typically, there's been very few releases, outright releases in the history of the company. The MO seems to be your contract comes due and perhaps it won't be renewed. And that is not viewed so much as a negative on AEW. And this was not a case of them just cutting our truth with years left on a deal. They were waiting for this contract to be renewed, but we saw what the reaction was here. Why do you think that there is that sort of different? Like, both of these companies, they can afford to keep anyone they want under contract, but there was quite a difference here in terms of reaction. Does it just come down to the R-Truth character just struck a chord with some people that, you know, some of the deals that come up in AEW have not?
I guess it's just the confluence of factors, that partly what you just went over, and that there have been some challenging PR stories for WWE and their fan relations. There's also the fact that Ron Killings was given a big push and wrestled John Cena right before this. So at least those two things that have come together around the scene. And Ron Killings, R-Truth being this, how long has he been in the company for?
This run goes back to 2008. So we're talking about a guy that's, you know, 17 years on this current run that he's, you know, he's just been part, like, not necessarily a push character for a long period of that time, but a fixture of its programming. And yeah, like, we're talking nearly two decades.
Yeah. I think those are the factors that you're not hearing this for. You're not, you know, saying, we want Carlito, but you're hearing, we want Truth.
All right. Well, there you go. That is, the latest on Ron Killings. Don't call him R-Truth anymore. Got his name. I mean, R-Truth came out of this, you know, he seemed like he understood, hey, this is a rare time. I've got a little bit of leverage and I'm going to push that. And it seems like, at worst, he's coming back. He's going to get some kind of a push. He's got new merchandise out, and he's appearing to have the character he wants to be doing, and shedding a lot of the comedic aspects as well. So, and he probably got a pretty nice deal out of this for this most likely last full-time wrestling contract.
I think the big takeaway from that promo is like, oh, this guy could have been a main eventer this whole time. Now we figured it out now that he's 50 something.
Yeah. Yeah. He was not too old back in 2008. And what I mean, certainly could have been perhaps utilized a lot better, and shouldn't have come as any kind of surprise if you were watching him in TNA, where he was much closer to this version than the comedy character that he played very well. But I don't know if that was necessarily his ceiling.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Fiscally responsible, financial geniuses, monetary magicians. These are things people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Because Progressive offers discounts for paying in full, owning a home, and more. Plus, you can count on their great customer service to help you when you need it, so your dollar goes a long way. Visit Progressive.com to see if you could save on car insurance. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states or situations. Support for this post-wrestling podcast comes from those of you who have picked up our merch over at Chalk Tees. T-shirts, hoodies, sweatshirts, and hats from post-wrestling and our network of shows, including the NWA Podcast, Poison Rana, The Long and Winding Royal Road, WrestleNomics, and MC Later. Free shipping to almost anywhere in the entire world. No minimum spend required. That's chop-tees.com/post-wrestling.
On to some other notes coming out of this week. Let's first touch upon WBD, which is splitting in half into two companies pending approval sometime in the middle of 2026. This is like the WBD brand split, where on one side we have David Zaslav, who's getting the SmackDown 6 and all of the future stars and the internet darlings, and Gunnar Wiedenfels is getting Raw with the Katie Vick angle, Evolution.
Big Show. No, he's on SmackDown.
Hot lesbian action. Yes.
Eric Bischoff. Yes.
Yeah. That is the delineation here. We've got, which is
3 minute warning.
Yeah. So we have streaming and studios, which is the David Zaslav side, and then global networks, which is already being affectionately referred to as Crapco until it gets its official name. I mean, dude, you think like wrestling media are like tough on some of its coverage? Get into some of these media analysts, dude. They are ruthless of these people that they cover. Crapco. Yes. So, Global Networks is going to assume most of the astounding debt that Warner Brothers Discovery has piled up, which amazingly was well over $50 billion when this merger went down 3 years ago. And part of the reason that David Zaslav is making $53 million per year is that he has reduced this debt pretty significantly over his term. But yes, the overarching question, this could have been our title on the video, but we don't want to mislead. What does this mean for AEW? Is this it? Are we putting our chips on the table? Is it game over for AEW?
You know, they did do an emergency conference call at WBD to address this for investors, and I listened to the entire thing, some 40 minutes or so. They did open it to Q&A, and I was extremely disappointed in the stock analysts. Not once did the subject of AEW come up, one of WBD's biggest partners. I was just shocked that they were not leading with the subject of professional wrestling. I wanted to know not only what does this mean for AEW, but does, so this is an important name we're going to have to learn here. And we've said it before on this program, Gunnar Wiedenfels. Yes. You know what, he has a reputation within WBD for, don't you?
Slashing, burning, and our favorite Mark Shapiro's words, efficiencies.
Is this, did we know what his opinion is of pro wrestling? Is he the next Jamie Kellner?
Was he influenced by Jim Barnett in his younger days?
We don't know.
That's the question here. We should explain to everyone here from like just a pure AEW perspective. So the cable assets minus HBO, all the cable assets are going to be on this global networks side, which I'm starting to grow an affinity for Crapco that we can call this. That will be where TNT and TBS is housed. However, HBO and HBO Max are going to be on the streaming and studio side. So obviously AEW is going to be connected to both of these companies, at least throughout the duration of this current contract that has another 3 years on top of it with that option at the end for 2028.
Yeah. And have we talked about, we've probably barely touched on it, right? However many months ago when NBCU is going to split out, some of its digital assets, its streaming assets from its traditional cable assets into what's Versant?
Versant.
Right? Versant. What does that mean for SmackDown on USA Network? What does that mean for WWE?
So I've read a lot about all of this, and it seems that everyone is just throwing out every theory possible. But one unifying expectation is the idea that these cable assets that were spun out into Versant and what is going to be this global networks stream could all be bundled together. That seems to be a very logical fit. That, yes, folks, there's your headline. TNT, TBS, and USA Network could all end up under the same ownership when all is said and done.
And then what happens to the wrestling world?
That's when Paul Levesque and Tony Khan come out on Raw and they hug on the stage.
I think even if they had the same, essentially the same TV partner, I don't think that would change that much, at least for the duration, at least for the term of the existing deals. To be clear, in the short term, I don't think this is going to mean that much for AEW. They have a contract. They have a TV contract. That's what, 3 years, 4 years? How long is there?
It goes till the end of 2027, but then there's the option for WBD to pick up 2028.
Potentially four, but definitely three. It would be very difficult to interrupt that contract, I would think. We have not obtained a copy of that contract, unfortunately, but I would think it would be very difficult to get out of that contract for WBD, and compared to some other properties, probably not that big of a contract. So I don't think that it's going to change anything in the short term. Could it affect how AEW is evaluated in the next round, depending on the makeup of the companies at that time? Sure, for sure.
AEW also falls under the entertainment portfolio for the company. And, you know, there's a lot of concern about what is the future of TNT Sports going to be. Of course, they're losing the NBA after this season. And as well, David Zaslav mentioning the fact that, you know, we have not found that live sports has been a big driver for HBO Max, but like, how is AEW viewed? And it may be very different between both sides of looking at it. Like, is this something that is more akin to sports and the habits of sports viewership, or is this more of an entertainment property that we view as something that can lead to people engaging on HBO Max, and what becomes of the AEW pay-per-views? Like, there's all of these questions that are not going to be answered until A, this is finalized, and B, closer to the end of this contract that is not coming up anytime soon. So I don't think anyone believing this is going to be some grand win or giant disappointment for AEW. It's just you're totally guessing at this point.
And to try to inject more nuance into this too, you know, we've heard Tony Khan speak a lot about David Zaslav, who, you know, presumably will not be in
charge. Is that his first name, David? I don't know if I've ever heard
Mr. Zaslav, excuse me. He will be in charge. He will not be in charge of TBS and TNT anymore. That will fall under Gunnar Weidenfeld, who will oversee people like Channing Dungey, is her name, right? Who oversees the entertainment television programming for WBD. So, I mean, if it's the case that Tony has this great relationship with David Zaslav, that won't be a factor as much, if at all, under this new configuration.
All right. Well, a big media story regardless, and where this will mature over the next year. As we have seen, mergers among media companies in the U.S. and changes of ownership, not exactly you snap your fingers and they happen. If you're Sherry Redstone or Paramount, we will see if they have an easier path over at Warner Brothers Discovery, as it's one of them. One of the most chaotic histories of a mass entertainment news organization. When you go back to AOL and Time Warner, like, the history of this thing is, there have been books written on it, and there will be probably more books written on it.
And David Zaslav, I believe on their quarterly calls included, has been open about the notion that it would be best for this industry for there to be consolidation. I don't think it's a secret that they've considered, some sort of merger, some kind of M&A action, be it with NBC Universal assets or Comcast or whatever it is. So that seems inevitable, but what we've got are these declining assets, and they've got these profitable cable companies that are largely reliant on your cable bill, on consumers' cable bills, but they are continuing to decline. We have a question from Gerard that pertains to this, who says, is Tony Khan aware of this WBD split, and is he planning somewhat ahead of this issue?
I would say 200% Tony Khan is aware of this WBD split. I think it made it to its inbox by now. In terms of, I don't know how you can plan for this at this early juncture. I don't think that even if you are right at the top of this, a David Zaslav or a Gunnar, you're going to necessarily have any kind of idea that far down your asset portfolio of what this is going to mean for an AEW. So I don't think if you're Tony Khan, you can do much more other than it is business as usual for the time being. This has not even finalized yet and will not be for about another year. So that's, you're in a holding pattern. And yeah, it should be of concern and awareness. But in terms of preparation, until you're kind of giving marching orders or some kind of strategy that they have for your property at that time, then you can, you know, assess.
And this is supposed to close 2026.
Mid-2026 is the estimate, yeah. Unless and there's so, any holdup.
And like I said, they've got at least 3 years. Maybe their option will be picked up. If it is, they've got 4 years to establish relationships if they don't already have the key relationships established.
And cable is, like, these assets, they're still making money for Warner Brothers Discovery in its present form. But the philosophy behind this is that we are going to continue to have an erosion of cable subscribers. So it's going to be this race of making enough cuts that can offset the loss of cable subscribers that we have. So you are going to see tons of slashing. And come 3 years from now, AEW may be looked at around like $200 million a year that, you know, cable, whatever your rock bottom number is, if cable still makes sense that we're going to continue this and it's programming that's an asset to us, they might be seen as a great value at that particular cost, because they don't want to be going out for major live sports to fulfill cable, and AEW falls into a sweet spot. Or they could just look at it that, hey, this is not a future that we are investing any significant value in, and AEW doesn't fit into it. Like, you could have both extremes as options on the table.
So you're saying this could be fine, but this could be the end for AEW.
Yeah, that's, I know that's
that's the window. That's the range of possible outcomes here.
Yeah, that's not a great SEO title for engagement. It could be great. It could be bad. But I know people like black and white, and that's not what we do. TKO Boxing. You know, this is the Netflix reality series I want, following around Dana White and Turki Alshake, who I thought was going to be the biggest reunion over the past week. But then I saw Elon Musk tweeting this morning, acknowledging some of my tweets about Donald Trump might have gone a little too far last week. And look at that. The richest man in the world waving the flag of surrender. That's power. Power in real time in a digital world. Well, Dana White was asked about this over the weekend at the UFC 316 press conference about what's going on. You were attached to this Terrence Crawford, Canelo Alvarez fight. Then Turki Alshake comes out and states that Sella, the Saudi Arabian outfit, would be the promoter of the event as they were moving it from September 12th to September 13th, location to be determined. And Dana just stated, you know, you can't believe all that stuff that's out there. It's like, Turki Alshake was the one, he is the source of this. He was the one who stated, you are not the promoter, it's going to be Sella. So anyway, he stated,
it's all part of the story.
Sit back and enjoy the ride. Man, to have Turki Alshake, Dana White, Paul Levesque, and Dwayne Johnson all at the boardroom table together. I mean, that is WWE unreal. So the details have now come out that they are all on the same page. The fight of the century, Canelo Alvarez against Terrence Crawford on Saturday, September 13th. They've stated it will be at Las Vegas, although they have not announced where. Because as of right now, there is a football game scheduled at Allegiant Stadium, which we will see if they end up bumping UNLV for this fight. But that is what's happening. And it will air on Netflix. Part of, as we love to call it, a strategic partnership with Riyadh Season. So they're also going to be doing a three-city promotional tour for this fight in Riyadh, June 20th, Fanatics Fest, that WWE is all over, June 22nd, and then they'll be in Vegas June 27th over International Fight Week.
You know what I've been meaning to mention the last few weeks, and this also pertains to what we're going to talk about later about WrestleMania, is that, I mean, for what it's worth, I don't know if this is a factor at all or if it is a minor factor or a major factor, is that you know who is one of the board members, I believe it's for the Las Vegas Stadium Authority organization?
Who is that name?
Lawrence Epstein.
That is right. Yes. Lawrence Epstein, longtime executive at UFC, part of their legal counsel. And yes, also a board member, as Brandon uncovered.
Well, it's right there on the website. So So he they oversee Allegiant Stadium. Yeah.
Yeah. So this is, I mean, Las Vegas, definitely the beneficiary of TKO. And yeah, Turkey Alshake, he sent out on X, "My brother Dana will promote this fight. It is the fight of Riyadh season, and we have a deal with TKO to promote it, and it will be the biggest fight in boxing." And then going on to state they would release the details and platform. So yes, Netflix, this will be their third major boxing event after Jake Paul and Mike Tyson last November. And July 11th, they're doing the third fight between Katie Taylor and Amanda Serrano on Netflix. So this will follow that in September, and appears to be everyone is back on the same page after about a month of confusion over what exactly was the status of TKO boxing or the relationship between Turkey and TKO itself.
And whatever was going on, if there were questions about what the distributor was going to be, it does turn out to be Netflix, and everyone will be able to watch it live. Is this going to be, this will not be near the level of the Mike Tyson, Jake Paul fight, right?
No, but this is going to be a big fight. Like for boxing, it's pretty big. You know, you're talking about, you know, Canelo Alvarez, that I think is still like a major star. This is a much higher quality opponent than Canelo has fought in some time. Terrence Crawford this is going to be as well an exercise in the promotional muscle that Saudi Arabia and TKO put behind this, which I don't think they are going to spare any expense in making big. I cannot imagine this is going to be at the Tyson Jake Paul level, that there's just such a morbid curiosity for that fight that crossed over in such a big way that even a fight like this, like, I can't imagine this disappointing, but not at that scale of fan.
And I think we'll get data for this on the Totem chart.
I hope so. I really hope
there was for the Tyson Paul fight. And this is also still going to be the same night as UFC's Mexico. Not a pay-per-view now, but a fight night, correct?
It's a fight night in San Antonio. So yeah,
San Antonio.
Yeah, they were supposed to run in Guadalajara, Mexico, but the arena there, which is being constructed, is not going to be available by that date. So they had to move the show to San Antonio, and now it's a free fight night special going against this, which is hardly the conflict that a pay-per-view would represent. They're just punting that pay-per-view to October the 4th. So that also clears the way for all of this. And yeah, and they landed on Netflix, which, I mean, Turkey was even talking about this being a pay-per-view. So even when it comes to the distribution, it seemed like this was up in the air over the last month as well before settling on Netflix and, you know, their continued relationship with TKO. Staying in Saudi Arabia, or in this case, a performer going to Saudi Arabia for the first time, is one Phil Brooks, who will headline Night of Champions on June 28th in Riyadh against John Cena. And why was this such a big deal? Why can't CM Punk just go without facing any potential backlash from his online audience? Well, that was because several years ago, when Phil was on Twitter one night, seeing a tweet by The Miz on the set of WWE Backstage, mocking him for changing the culture, one of CM Punk's famous lines, Punk responded to him at the time, "Go suck a blood money covered dick in Saudi Arabia, you fucking dork." And I think a lot of people, they forgot the fucking dork part at the end of this whole thing. Since then, the two have buried the hatchet, so to speak. And now Punk, after, you know, he's been back in the company since November of 2023. He has never gone to any Saudi Arabia show, whether to wrestle or even to appear, but he will make his first voyage over to Riyadh on June the 28th. And, you know, because of this tweet, and it is CM Punk that, you know, I don't think too many fans hold wrestlers to too high a kind of standard, but Punk is one of those guys that his brand is authenticity to his audience. And I saw more like backlash towards this than maybe I was expecting after Monday's match announcement, but maybe I shouldn't have been surprised by that. I guess the only question is if Punk in any meaningful way will talk about this in any sense, or he's just going to do the match and let people issue their angry tweets towards Phil Brooks.
I thought it was... I sense that they were mindful of this in how it was laid out on television on Monday, right? Where like Punk challenged him to a match right there and then, But Cena responded by saying, no, you've got to fight me in Saudi Arabia, as if like Saudi Arabia was this heel entity, you know?
Which is, yeah, I mean, it's not like
Punk, I know you don't want to do it there.
It's certainly, it was designed, like, if you know what he's referencing, you know. But if not, you would have just been, you know, there's Punk. He's just immediately agreeing to this match.
It's the only way he can get the match. He's got to go against his values.
Yeah, so that's it. That's his explanation for going over there. I mean, it's at a point now where I don't know how much. There's definitely still the sentiment among audiences towards these Saudi Arabia shows. But, I mean, we have seen now every performer, and there weren't a number of them, but at one time Cena was among them that were not going to these Saudi Arabia shows, and now everyone goes to these shows and everyone's in business with Saudi Arabia, and this company is deep in business with Saudi Arabia. So I mean, I always, as soon as the Royal Rumble was announced, I assumed if Punk is this last holdout, I couldn't fathom this guy was going to miss a show of that level. And once you're committing to going there eventually, you might as well be doing it now. But he does come across hypocritical, certainly, from, you know, his previous stance. And this was also a promo that was baked in with Punk stating, I do not work for TKO and those billionaires. And the end result is, you know, I'm acquiescing and going to the most profitable shows that this company stages.
And there's nobody's being left out at this point. Sami Zayn's been at multiple Saudi Arabia shows at this point, right? And
Kevin Owens
and even John Cena was not going after the first one, as well as
Daniel Bryan. To that greatest Royal Rumble, yeah. But then did not return for up until the Solo Sikoa match
after the Khashoggi murder, I believe.
Yes. The greatest Royal Rumble was April of 2018, and Jamal Khashoggi was murdered in October. So about a month out from that, I think, Crown Jewel show that they did, and that was kind of the peak of the controversy of going to Saudi Arabia. But there you have it. Now everyone accounted for, and CM Punk included. Let's talk a bit about WrestleMania 42. If you are keeping track of where in the world is WrestleMania, it has bounced from New Orleans, and now it is official for Las Vegas at Allegiant Stadium, April 18th and 19th of 2026, and a press release was issued just this morning, and some of the highlights from this press release include the fact that they are in partnership once again with the Las Vegas Convention and Visitors Authority. Right there, in bold letters, everyone. So this will be, it says here, it marks the, it comes on the heels of a historic WrestleMania 41 this past April in Las Vegas, which became the most successful and highest grossing event in WWE history. And a quote here from Nick Khan himself, Las Vegas helped to deliver the biggest WrestleMania of all time, shattering records and delivering an amazing week for fans around the world. We look forward to once again working with the talented and effective teams at the Las Vegas Convention and Visitors Authority and Allegiant Stadium to bring WrestleMania back to the sports and entertainment capital of the world. With Steve Hill, the president and CBO of the Las Vegas CBA, we're honored that WWE has once again selected Las Vegas to host the biggest event on their calendar. Bringing WrestleMania 42 to Las Vegas underscores our city's reputation for elevating world-class events to new heights. We're excited to build on last year's success and deliver an even more incredible experience for the WWE universe in 2026. And as many years include, they will also be bringing Raw, SmackDown, Stand and Deliver, and WWE World in partnership with Fanatics events. So I'm just questioning, did WWE pick Las Vegas or did Las Vegas pick WWE?
What I was hearing from the get-go is that, you know, when I started to look into whether or not New Orleans was really going to lose this, which is what I was told, that it was Las Vegas that was going to be. It was, you know, sort of one in the same group. I think they already had it in hand, was the impression that I get. But we will be trying to learn more through records quests and things like that, and see if there's anything more to learn here.
And the wait is on if you're in New Orleans. One of these years, you're owed a WrestleMania. Yeah. We'll see if that happens. Brandon and I put out a story last week. How does the travel ban that was recently instituted by the U.S., how does it affect TKO? Well, it was enough that it had TKO officials issue an internal memo, more so on the UFC side than the WWE side. But for those of you that have not been following this news, there are 12 countries that essentially, if you do not have a valid visa, you will not be able to enter the country. And this includes Afghanistan, Burma, Chad, the Republic of Congo, Equatorial Guinea, Eritrea, Haiti, Iran, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and Yemen, as well as partial suspensions for entry of several other countries, including Cuba, Venezuela, and several others as well. So, I mean, more so the concern is that the UFC operates with so many fighters across so many different countries that, you know, are not going to have, you know, visas or necessarily living in the U.S. Whereas WWE, this is, it's not a case where they are like flying in people on any kind of semi-regular basis throughout the year. Now, it might affect some, but we don't have any names yet that this could impact. But just based on the language of this memo, it seemed to be much more focused upon the UFC and its international fighters.
And this went into effect Monday, so this is in effect now. One thing that is noted in the memo is that, so anybody, and it's noted in the executive order as well, is that anybody who already has a valid visa, an existing visa, it's not like those are being thrown out and you're being kicked out of the country. The memo from UFC personnel does say that that could change and we'll monitor it, but everybody's existing visa is, you know, apparently still good. I'll point out too, and we pointed out in the article, the TKO annual report does detail, as it does every year. Sort of, this is, we've got this great diverse makeup of talent from all these different countries, and certainly they do. They say the UFC's got 650 athletes from more than 70 countries. WWE has 230 talents from more than 20 countries. As they always do, they say that, you know, they have 20% of WWE's developmental talent comes from outside the US, including Nigeria, Japan, England, Chile, Australia, Canada, Ukraine, Haiti, Singapore, and Switzerland. And Haiti is one of those countries that's on that list for full suspension. But we don't know of anybody who's being immediately affected by this.
Yeah, so one, just to monitor that this could be something. It was interesting. We had a question sent into our mailbag just about a week ago asking about this as well. And lo and behold, this memo came forward and we were made aware of. On to Vince McMahon, its own chapter on the show on a weekly basis. He is selling more TKO stock and
he's buying WWE. He's buying WWE back.
Well, you know what?
Is he buying WWE back?
You know what? I think it's time to squash these rumors right now. And who better to squash these than a guy just casually out on the streets of New York being flanked by a roving reporter to find out, is Vince McMahon going to buy back WWE?
I gotta ask you, I know there's been speculation that you and your dad might start your own wrestling company. Is that true?
You never know what's going to happen out there. Of course, anything can happen in WWE, but those rumors are false.
Okay. I know. I mean, if not, any chance you would join the AEW maybe?
Had a meeting with AEW and wish them, you know, continued success. Or whatever, but it's not WWE. It's not the company I helped build. But you never know what's going to happen in this business.
I know there was another rumor, so many, but there was another one about, you know, your dad buying Zach into WWE. What is going on with that?
Well, he owns a big part of TKO still, so you never know what's going to happen there either. So I'm not trying to be vague. I'm just saying anything can happen.
Of course. And how's your dad been doing lately? How's he been doing?
He's been doing really well. He's enjoying, you know, getting a little, he's enjoying life. You know, getting a little bit of a rest in there, but, you know, if you know my dad, he's always gung-ho, and he's always doing the next thing, and that's what he's focused on.
Nothing to see here. Anything can happen, per the words of Shane McMahon. No, we are not starting a new wrestling company, and does Vince McMahon own a big part of TKO?
He does, and he still does, but just after we finished recording last week, new filing dropped from the Securities and Exchange Commission. Endeavor has acquired more than 1.5 million additional shares of TKO. They already have 61%, but now they've got about an additional 1%, bringing them up to about 62%. Where did they get these shares from? If you read the footnotes here, it says 1.579 million shares of Class A common stock from Vincent K. McMahon in a private transaction Basically, they paid Vince $250 million, which is market value, for about 1% of the company. So now Vince went from about 4%, no controversy on the math here, went from about 4% of the company to 3%, and Endeavor went from about 61% to 62%. So Vince still has quite a bit. He still has 3% of TKO, which is the parent company of WWE. And that would be the opposite of buying WWE back.
Yeah, I don't. I mean, just
he's selling more of the parent company of WWE to the current controlling owners.
It's just amazing that story gathered enough to justify a Shane McMahon needing to throw a wet blanket over that story. Like this idea that Vince McMahon was going to storm back and secure his company that is no longer his company. I mean, makes for a nice story, but
the subtext there is that, so Shane is still pretty close and maybe even working closely with Vince.
I have, there's nothing to support this, but the idea of Shane somehow ending up in this 14th and I company, I think is a totally logical fit for Shane McMahon, who seems to be, it's still very close with his father. And, you know, we have seen of this 14th and I company. We know Brad Blum is there. And we know of like other former, you know, WWE employees that appear to be migrating over there as well. Like, what are you going to do when you're launching a new company? You're going to rely on people that you've worked with in the past and people that are considered on your team. And, you know, Shane McMahon would certainly fall into that category as well.
Yes. Yeah. And we don't really know what Shane did leave the company in 2009 and was not in the company again. He came back only as a performer, not as an executive in 2016. So, and he even said what he said. He did say publicly right in his interview at one point with Mick Foley about, you know, it stopped being fun. So there was apparently some stresses there, but he could be working more closely with him again.
Yes. And I was waiting for the follow-up from the TMZ interviewer about, did you ever consider stabbing your father in the heart as Paul Heyman described in the Netflix series when he challenged you to...
Oh, that's right, with a steak knife or something? Somebody was eating a steak. Yeah, take
you
this
want
knife.
This? Come, yeah. You've got to take it from me.
Yeah.
Interesting father-son dynamic there. All right, and the latest on the Dr. Carlin Kolker and Callis Holland Law Firm case. Where are we at over this? This is a defamation suit that was filed by Carlin Kolker against both lawyer Ann Callis and her law firm, Holland Law Firm, LLC.
Yes, notably not against Janelle Grant, but against Janelle Grant's attorney.
I think also misspelling Ann.
Yes, she spells it with no E at the end, and they have spelled it with an E again. In any case, so Dr. Kolker and Peak Wellness moved earlier this week for a default judgment against the law firm, but not against Ann Callis. How this works is you have a 3-week clock that starts ticking the moment that you are served with the lawsuit. The law firm was served before Ann Callis by something like 2 weeks. So their 3-week window has passed. And so they're saying, wait, your time is up. We're asking the court for a default judgment. So we'll see what happens. Presumably Ann Callis and the law firm that she works for, Holland Law Firm, will be represented by similar representation. We'll see if they're able to request an extension or something like that on the time that they have to respond.
This past weekend, WWE was in Inglewood, California for 2 shows on Saturday with Worlds Collide at the Kia Forum that drew over 10,000 people, and then Money in the Bank later that night at the Intuit Dome. And WWE did issue a press release, and they were promoting the fact that between its English and Espanol YouTube channels, that their peak of concurrent live viewership during the main event between El Hijo del Vikingo and Chad Gable was over 764,000 live viewers, which would be a record for WWE for a online presentation. And then, touting just the social stats that the show was able to generate. Really, its competition would be all these other kickoff shows. I mean, we don't really have the precedent of WWE live streaming any kind of major show on YouTube beyond, you know, they had, you know, Mixed Match Challenge was a series they did years ago, but that was on Facebook. Anyway, they've done stuff on Twitter, obviously, with Speed. But in terms of, like, YouTube, like, this is kind of an anomaly. So the show was really well received. I didn't know how high the success of the show was until Brandon informed me that even he tuned in for a bit of this show as well.
I did catch the main event.
To check it out as well. But I think overall,
at,
like,
at this point, real quick, at this point, there are 3.1 million views on the English video, and there are an additional 2 million on the Spanish language. So what's that? 5.1 million views. For what that's worth, this is a 2.5 hour video. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, it seemed like this came off really well. If you were, you know, if you are a regular viewer of AAA, like, it certainly was a very different presentation than a typical AAA show, but it was, you know, not insulting in any way. And I think that they really worked hard to emphasize the history of the company, like historical features on the When Worlds Collide show in 94, on Antonio Pena, the history of Triple Mania, and the launch of this company in 1992. Like, this was hardly WWE Mexico that they were just stamping this on, and this is WWE usurping the brand of AAA. Like, this felt, they wanted to give this a feel of something different to WWE, but still you could see produced as a WWE event, if that makes sense.
Yes, and I think the big story coming away from this is Mr. Iguana, right?
Yes, the man that was in high demand coming off of this weekend and got a vignette on Raw and then appearing in the crowd on NXT Tuesday night, and they were very quick to boom, slap a logo on a shirt, and now for $34.99, this men's black Mr. Iguana shirt can be yours as well. Jesus, 5XL. You can go up to 5XL for these shirts.
You can.
Wow. Okay. Well, there you have it. Mr. Iguana is going to come out of this just fine, I think. Hold on to those rights to the name. That would be my advice.
Do you have a sense of, like, how big of a star is he within AAA?
I mean, he's been sort of like a comedy fixture for a long time. I think he's been way better received here to this WWE audience than he was in AAA, where I think he was kind of divisive to some fans as well. But, I mean, it is interesting just how much this guy has stood out over just a handful of appearances. And, you know, a puppet is the key to someone's heart, and they better not tease not renewing this guy's contract, because I think the response would be very negative if they did such a thing.
I'm not sure if you can you chant Mr. Iguana, though. They'll have to come up with some sort of creative chant.
Well, in another era, they might have changed his name and changed everything about him, but I don't think they're going to go down that path with him. Or he could be a heel within 6 months. Who knows? Fast forwarding to Money in the Bank, this was their return to the Intuit Dome after that staged the Netflix debut back in January. And the January show did a $4.8 million gate. And while we didn't get an exact number for this show, they said they did set their gate record at the Intuit Dome. So you have to imagine this was north of $5 million for Money in the Bank. And thankfully, they did a $5 million gate to justify bringing R-Truth back.
Yeah, I think they can afford it. That is slightly surprising to me. That, I mean, the raw premiere on Netflix was, in terms of hype, I mean, bigger than anything other than, like, WrestleMania or maybe Royal Rumble, right? Like, that was one of the biggest W shows of the year. It will be, right? Nonetheless, this is another PLE, and maybe they've become even more ambitious with the ticket prices, and they sold enough of them according to this to break the record.
This has to be now considered their best domestic market. I think, you know, New York would, like, New York is still not doing, like, $5 million gates. And the cost just involved.
When's the last time MSG had a pay-per-view that we would
really you have to go back a lot. I think a Survivor Series was there. No, Barclays has housed so many of them now.
Sure.
It's kind of been limited to TV these last couple of years as well. But I mean,
yeah,
geez, like we're talking about like $10 million between two shows in the span of less than 6 months that they have run at the Intuit Dome. So yeah, there you have it. All right. We will end off with a couple of ratings notes. And I want to go all the way back to last Wednesday because we haven't spoken to you since then, because that was AEW and WBD's 4-hour Firefest taking place on TBS.
Firefest or Fighter Fest?
Fighter Fest. Sorry, did I say Fire Fest?
It sounded like it to me.
Anyway. I felt like I had just come out of Fire Fest by the end of these 4 hours with an overrun. Dude, they did an overrun. It's like, you've got to be kidding me. So, look at this. The whole quarterly breakdown.
This is a lot to jam into one chart.
Yeah, you had to, man, that's some superimposed text. Definitely requires some increase. So
I want to be able to actually read it. You're going to have to sign up for the Patreon and zoom in.
That's how you bring them in, Brandon. Yeah. But running 8 till midnight, and it was interesting. Like, the structure of this show, like, they programmed this instead of, like, one booking this as a four-hour block. It was more closely aligned to they book Dynamite, and then they book Collision. And it really, like, from just a positioning standpoint, kind of peaked just after 10 p.m. where, you know, they finished the four-way with Kenny Omega and then followed that with a Will Ospreay match with Lio Rush that was made earlier in the show. And the rest of the show, it felt like a typical Collision where it was lesser star power, strong wrestling, but it felt as though the idea was the big promoted aspects were all going to be contained in that two-hour window. And, you know, the first 2 hours did 655,000 viewers and a 0.18, which, you know, a very good 18 to 49 number, especially for, like, Dynamite standards. And then the 10:06 to 12:06, roughly, period, 380,000 viewers and a 0.10. So they were definitely down in those final 2 hours. But if you throw out the collisions that had that NBA lead in, this would have been the best 18 to 49 number for a Collision since April 12th. So, I mean, you can certainly look at this and, yeah, you're losing viewership for those final 2 hours, but it's doing better than what TBS would be doing in those 2 hours. And it did better than a lot of these recent Collisions have been doing as well on separate nights, whether they be Thursday or Saturday. Those were some of my thoughts.
Maybe this is something you do on a, you know, four times a year basis, do a 4 hour block for some heavily hyped, especially branded show like this.
I do not think this would hold up if they did this on any kind of regular basis. Like, I was totally burned out after these 4 hours, and they're doing it again tonight. So we will see if there's any change in patterns this week. I think you can get away with this every now and then. Four is pushing it. I think three would be what I would limit it to, but you know, it's something that you can hype up and do sparingly. And I think the numbers would suggest that there's enough of an audience that will stay through for the full 4 hours after the fact. Then we go to SmackDown on Friday night, and there was a lot of focus on the previous week's SmackDown number, which did win the night, but did not get any kind of a boost with John Cena and Cody Rhodes appearing. Well, this week, going into Money in the Bank, they were up 3% in viewers with 1,424,000 viewers and up 24% with a 0.42 in the 18 to 49 demo, their highest in that demo since April 25th and second for the night on cable behind the College Softball World Series, which I didn't know this was such a juggernaut on sports programming, but college softball, they're not messing around in the U.S. and also benefited from the fact that SmackDown, I think it only went against I think they had no NBA or NHL on Friday, if I'm not mistaken.
No, they couldn't have, yeah, because college softball was number one. So I'm sure at least NBA would have been ahead of that. I will check while we're talking here.
So that was the SmackDown number. And then we will go, well, before we go into Raw on Netflix, I want to play this clip. This is from our friends at the Lightshed podcast, a frequent guest of our show, Brandon Ross, along with Rich Greenfield, discussing both the previous week's SmackDown number and sort of Netflix viewership and whether there is any concern over WWE viewership across these platforms and its PLE performances as well.
The thesis was that viewership overall would increase because of the Netflix deal on Monday Night Raw. Look, every other area of the business is crushing it. Ratings are sagging a little bit. Not exactly sure why, because, you know, by most opinions, the content's been okay. So maybe it's just hit an air pocket here. We'll see. I'm not that worried about it in the near term, given the metrics across the rest of the business and some of the ups and downs that we've seen in viewership over the years at WWE. And frankly, you know, what matters the most for them right now in the moment is how the PLEs are performing, because that is the deal that's up.
Well, we also have UFC,
and
right?
They have been doing quite well. It's interesting with UFC because UFC has had a broader engagement issue than WWE. WWE, we're talking about this, you know, one Friday night. UFC buys have obviously been down. Revenues from pay-per-views have kind of flatlined, and now they are in a renewal. So it's a much more pressing issue, again, despite the fact that the entire rest of the business is crushing it for UFC.
Renewal talks with ESPN appear to be the furthest along. Amazon Prime and Netflix are also in the room. Amazon, I'm told, is most interested in the pay-per-view business. No shocker there. The wild card is Warner Brothers Discovery, which obviously needs more content, but I can't see Zaslav spending money here at all.
There you go. Definitive statement on David Zaslav and his monetary desire to go after UFC programming. But that takes us to the latest Netflix numbers for Raw. This was for the June 2nd episode of the program, so a week ago Monday, with 2.7 million views, up slightly from the week prior, 5 million hours viewed. This was 8th globally, 4th in the U.S., 6th in Canada, among the 6 countries of where it ranked. And we also had, for Money in the Bank, of course, this excludes the U.S. where it streamed on Peacock, it ranked in 19 countries in the top 10, but did not rank globally. So under 2.1 million views worldwide, but Canada among them, Mexico, the U.K., and Saudi Arabia as they get set for their return of the WWE in 2.5 weeks' time.
And just real quick, there was a NHL Stanley Cup game on Friday night. I don't think this was in the Programming Insider report originally.
It was not initially. Yeah. Okay. That was where my confusion was. But yes, there was right, the Oilers Panthers.
So that Stanley Cup was number one on cable. Softball World Series was number two. SmackDown was number three. It did 2.7 million global views. I've done more math. Here's a table.
You gotta subscribe to the Patreon too if you want these.
This isn't even
figures.
On the Patreon. Let's not false advertise. I don't know what to make of these numbers other than, you know, this is what Netflix reports. Is there something deceptive going on? I would need to see more evidence and more data to be confident that there's something deceptive or some significant methodology change that's misrepresenting these numbers in an exaggerated way.
If you could take, like, you have gone through so many of these numbers, and even allowing for, you know, that there can be a range of perhaps where some of these numbers fall, do you have any kind of sense of, like, are these numbers concerning at all to you? Do you feel that they are sort of is this what you maybe would expect that these numbers to be accounting for, even a best case, worst case scenario?
More or less. I think, you know, I think there are good reasons. Like, I'm not as bullish on this idea. Like it seems like Brandon Ross is at Light Shed that Netflix is going to have this great immediate downstream effect. I don't think we felt that way before they came to Netflix, and I know that is an argument, and I remember articulating that is what they're hoping for, but I didn't necessarily.
And that was also the discussion when they moved to Fox. It was kind of, you heard that same chatter that this was going to be this big trickle down effect because WWE was on a major broadcaster on a weekly basis, and that did not bear itself out.
Now, I do think similar things mattered when it came to putting the pay-per-views on the W Network in 2014, and we saw consumer metrics rise coinciding with the beginning of that, and then we saw consumer metrics recover coinciding with the beginning of PLEs moving to Peacock. But that was really raising the reach of that really special peak content. The case of SmackDown on Fox, the case of Raw on Netflix, probably, I mean, in both cases, it moves those shows into more homes, but not that many more homes. Maybe there's something about Netflix that it's a younger audience and it's a smaller audience, and that's not where people want to go to watch live stuff. That could be. As far as like, is there something concerning here? Not really. I don't know. Like, these aren't great numbers, but they're pretty stable. I mean, what are the year-over-year differences? SmackDown is way down, but it's down from being on Fox. So how do you evaluate that? It's at least on this line chart, it looks pretty flat since it's been on USA Network. It's not like they're bleeding viewers over time since they've been there since September. The number that I'm estimating, and it's just an estimate. We can all have different opinions on what the numbers really are, but I'm estimating it. Yeah, they're slightly down. They are in slightly more homes than the USA Network. I think that's pretty indisputable at this point, given the decline of US cable versus the relative ubiquity of Netflix. So it's probably more advantageous in terms of household coverage to be on Netflix, but they do appear to be at least slightly down. Now you look at we could always look to attendance to say that's really the cleanest measure of, I think, of your fan popularity. And we're still seeing, despite these really high ticket prices that WWE fans have never seen before, we're still seeing pretty strong averages here that are a lot stronger than a couple years ago, and it's not declining. So I think they're okay. We can all, say what you want to say about the product and whether or not it's earning new fans and earning sustaining fans. And that's a worthy conversation to have, but we're not seeing big negatives bared out here to me.
One other note on the Netflix front, SmackDown from Friday night, it ranked in the top 10 in one country. Do you want to hazard to guess what that particular region is?
Could that be the future 51st state of the United States?
No, it is not.
Okay.
The underappreciated Bolivia, which never fails to show up like consistently, no matter what WWE programming is thrown out on Netflix, Bolivia is there, folks.
Well, they should do a major PLE in Bolivia then, maybe.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe that's where Bo Dallas ends up spearheading, and they can Bo leave in Bolivia.
NXT Bolivia. It's probably a good time to address another question from Drod. It says, what must be done to reinstate the cable business?
Easy.
A time machine would be good. The destruction of all internet connectivity would be also helpful. Any other ideas?
Yeah. I mean, part of it is like a lot of these like cable, like they're still profitable. It's not like these things are bleeding money for these companies. The problem is like it's going in one direction. And are we just going to continue at this rate that is just going to go down, 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 down? Will there be a plateau where it just hits and there's going to be an audience that just will not get rid of cable, just like they would not get rid of a home telephone? That these are technologies that they are just not going to cut the cord away from. But I think ultimately, like this is going to be an industry that's going to reinvent itself through streaming, and it's going to be probably very similar to you, the consumer, but it's going to be a lot less profitable than 10 years ago of the cable industry, when we were talking about ESPN having 100 million subscribers, and they're going to be less than half of that. I don't think there's like a turning around of cable where it's going to be this monster in terms of having such widespread cable subscribers. Like it's been fractured to such a degree, and it's just going to be trying to replicate as much of that through streaming and other options. Like I don't think there's a turning around of this. It's just trying to prolong this technology as long as you possibly can. And for some people, it will be their lifetime. They will not go without cable.
I think a lot has been done over the decades to destroy the brand that is cable from all of our cable companies. John, you've had your own issues with companies like Rogers, who have met vitriol on this platform. But just, it's so difficult. And anybody who's ever tried to cancel their cable or tried to call their cable company about some problem has been frustrated, because they don't want you to leave. So they've spent a lot of their brand power and brand trust to try to retain people. And it's not very flexible. And I don't know if there's any way to repair that at this point. People, especially younger people, much prefer and are much able to engage with flexible products like Netflix.
And that's going to be kind of the next wave of, well, it more so concerns AEW in the short term, but it will come up for WWE too when the SmackDown deal is up and their Netflix deal is up, is that if you're staring at way more lucrative streaming options, like the idea of having no cable or network window for your product, like that's what these companies are going to be facing, I think, at a certain time, and whether they believe from a strategy standpoint, like, will that be of any consequence to us to no longer have an avenue through traditional television versus these streaming options that I think they will have plenty of opportunities to go all in on streaming when some of these deals come up.
I do think, like, related to brand effects, I think what cable networks, maybe not your telecom company, but what cable networks still have and what the broadcast networks still have is, I heard somebody say this on a podcast somewhere, not a wrestling podcast, where they said that it's like product packaging, or it's like mail packaging. You get something, you know, from a FedEx envelope. It's been overnighted to you in a FedEx envelope. You open that right away because you're like, oh, what's in there? Just as if you were, you know, there's some, you know, programming out there that's being packaged in, you know, on NBC's, you know, network platform or Fox. That's an important package. That's an important marketing vehicle to get people to engage with it. Whereas if you had just, I don't know, live streamed it on YouTube or something like that.
We're going to close out the show at this point. So thanks to everyone for your questions and for joining along as we have brought you up to date as best we can on everything going on in the world of pro wrestling and even some boxing today. The countdown is on till September 13th. What a night it will be. Brandon, what is happening over at WrestleNomics?
Oh, there's a big social media report that I put out. Did you know that The Rock has more Instagram followers? You got a question. Are all of his Instagram followers real? But he has more Instagram followers. Some 393 million, I think, is the number. That's more than every WWE talent that I could find, plus every AEW talent I could find combined.
Wow. These wrestlers got to be doing some cheat meals or something.
I don't know.
At 4 in the morning?
Yeah. Yeah, so all of that is on... as well as, you know, everybody's Twitter followers, and I'm redoing a weekly update of attendance and other things, as well as all of the TV reports in their full entirety, which is not just for TV ratings, but also shows attendance trends and YouTube trends and even some cage match data in there. All of that is both on Substack and Patreon.
Fantastic stuff. Check out all of the work of Brandon Thurston. And you can keep up to date with us over at postwrestling.com. Tonight, Wei Ting will be joined by Kate from Montreal to go through the four-hour summer blockbuster. I've got my limits, everyone, so I will have the night off. But I will be back tomorrow with Wei Ting. We're doing a special Rewind Away on this kind of a under-the-radar documentary series on Katsuyori Shibata when he first started as the coach of the New Japan LA Dojo. This was about a year and a half after his near-fatal incident with Kazuchika Okada, and he was assigned the head training role over at the LA Dojo. So we'll be talking about this this five-part doc series that New Japan World put out back at that time, involving a young Carl Fredericks, Clark Connors, Alex Coughlin. That's coming up at postwrestlingcafe.com on Thursday. So thanks to everyone for joining us. We're back and here every single Wednesday, 1 p.m. Eastern time on both the Post Wrestling and WrestleNomics feeds, and we'll speak with you next Wednesday. This month at postwrestlingcafe.com, go XL and you get live editions of Rewind to Raw, Rewind to Dynamite, and Rewind to SmackDown, featuring all the news of the day, your questions and answers, as well as feedback. Postwrestlingcafe.com, $6 gets you in the door.